If I haven't met you, my name is Grant, and I get to be a pastor here. And I'm going to launch us into this series called If Only. You see, a few years ago now, quite a while back, there was a guy named Phil Connors. And Phil Connors, he was kind of your average weatherman. And he was working at a news station doing the weather, and he was doing a great job. But his bosses decided he needed to get out of the studio and go report in the field on a segment. And he was dragging his feet. He didn't want to do it. And he made it very clear that he didn't, but he didn't have a choice. And so one of his colleagues, Rita, and a cameraman named Larry, they jump in the van and they go to report on this story that they've got to report on. And he gets there, and they get there a day early. They check into their bed and breakfast to rest for the day before the report. And he wakes up the day that he's supposed to go do this news story, and the alarm goes off, and Sonny and Cher are singing "I've Got You, Babe" on the radio, and he's just like, "You're kidding," and he turns it off, and he gets ready for the day, and then he goes and he finds where he's supposed to do the report, and he does a half-hearted report at best on whether or not Punxsutawney Phil has seen his shadow and whether they're going to get 6 more weeks of winter. And then he wants to go home and he's done, but Rita and Larry, they want to enjoy the festivities that are there. And so he just goes back to the hotel. Phil goes back and he goes to bed, and he wakes up the next morning, and it's 6 a.m. and Sonny and Cher are singing "I've Got You, Babe." And he's like, "Listen, I know that these radio stations play the same song over and over again, but they do it the same time every day." And he begins to live out his day, and that's when he realizes he's in a time warp, right? He's in a time loop. And if you haven't already figured it out, this didn't really happen. This is the plot of Groundhog Day, right? The classic movie featuring Bill Murray as Phil Connors. And what's fascinating about that movie is he's now in this time loop where he's reliving the same day over and over and over. And the point of the film, it's kind of a commentary on human existence, where they're going, "Well, we want you to figure out what is the meaning of life." And so this character played by Bill Murray is trying to figure out what is the meaning for his life. And so he does what many of us do in that moment. He's like, "Well, listen, if I'm just going to live forever and it's going to go over and over and over again, then I'm going to begin to indulge myself in all of the things that the world has said will give me purpose and meaning." And so he spends some time in one-night stands, and he spends some time binge drinking and then learning as much as that he can learn, and then going around and just he gets so frustrated because none of that satisfies, that then he begins to just try to figure out ways to get out of the time loop, and he can't. And so he goes, "Well, I'm just going to start learning as much as I can learn and just gaining more and more in the world." And so he learns how to play the piano, and he teaches himself how to be an ice sculptor, which I'm like, "Bro, you got all the time in the world and you're learning ice sculpting. Like, Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania must be really boring if that's what you're going after." And he does all of these things, and he still can't figure out the meaning of life. In fact, this week I did some research on the theories behind how long was Phil in this time loop. Like, this is the kind of stuff I research for you, okay? I went down a deep, dark rabbit hole this week. There is some crazy theories about this classic movie. And the one that's gained the most traction is they think that he stayed in that time loop for something like 12,395 days. It's 34 years. 34 years of living it over and over and over to find the meaning of life. And eventually, if you know the way the movie ends, he finds that meaning by realizing that life is not to be lived out of selfish ambition for ourselves, but for others. Now, if I was to ask you, say, "Okay, hey, if you were to be given the opportunity to live that life, to spend 34 years just trying to figure out what is your meaning of life, would you want to do that?" Most of us, knowing the movie, would say, "No, not at all. Not at all. That living in a loop like that, that sounds more like hell than it does life. I don't want that at all." But I also think, if we're honest with ourselves, and the reality is most of us are doing it anyway. Oh, it's not the exact same day over and over and over again, but we wake up every single day going, "What is the meaning of this? Universe, what is the purpose of my life?" And we're chasing after one thing and then another thing and then another thing and another thing, continually trying to fill a void and give ourselves a purpose and a meaning to wake up and to keep going. And we keep filling it with things that are never going to satisfy. Phil wasn't the only one, though, in this movie that's dealt with this, because it's not a fictional concept. It's real life for us. It's a human condition. In the Old Testament, there's a man by the name of Solomon. There's a man, Saul's there too, but there's a guy in the Old Testament named Solomon. And Solomon, he's the third king of Israel after his dad, David. And he becomes the king when it's sort of at the height of Israel's reign. They're just about to come into the peak of Israel as a nation. And Solomon, as he comes in to his reign, God comes to him and says, Solomon, I'm willing to give you anything you ask of me. And Solomon says, then I want wisdom and I want knowledge. Give me wisdom and knowledge. And God says, okay, Solomon, because you didn't ask for wealth, I'm gonna give you wealth. And because you didn't ask for your enemies to be overthrown, I'm gonna give you a season of peace. And because you didn't ask for a long life, I'm gonna give you that. And I'm going to give you knowledge and wisdom. And so Solomon, being king, he takes all of this knowledge and wisdom, and then because he can just do what he wants, he has all of the wealth that he desires, and he has all of the resources, and nobody's going to tell him no. So Solomon then spends a season of his life pursuing every single thing that he can to find the meaning of life. And he always has God in view, but he's going, I really do wonder if you can find the meaning of life somewhere outside of this God. And so over the next 4 weeks, we're going to be looking in the book of Ecclesiastes. If you've got your Bibles, you can go ahead and turn there. We're going to be in Ecclesiastes chapter 1 in a moment. The words will be behind me on the screen as always. But the book of Ecclesiastes, it's sort of Solomon's cynical reflection on all of the things that he's chased after. And if you read it through the beginning of it, you tend to get a little bit depressed almost. Because he says, I've pursued all of these things and yeah, they don't satisfy. And so we're going to look at this idea of, well, if I only did more. If I only did more, then man, I can just get over the next hill and accomplish things. Or if I only had more, just give me more wealth and then I can be sacrificially generous and really do it. Or if I only experienced more, if I just had better experiences that could teach me things, or if I had had different experiences in the past, then my life would be better. Or today, we're going to be looking at if I only knew more. If I only knew a little bit more. If I was just a bit wiser, if I was just a little more intelligent. We put it this way though, right? This is how we say it. If I only knew then what I know now. And that we're constantly looking at life and saying, yeah, I mean, life is good, but I need more wisdom. I need more intelligence. I need more knowledge because that is going to satisfy and give me the meaning of life. And we're going to find in Solomon that he pursues that and he says, intelligence and intellect and knowledge makes for a really bad God. Here's what he says in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, starting in verse 12. I, the teacher, was king of Israel and I lived in Jerusalem. I devoted myself to search for understanding and to explore by wisdom everything being done under the sun. He says, listen, I am the great teacher now. I have all of the wisdom and I have devoted myself to do it. This idea of devotion, it carries with it this concept of I'm going to set my heart, I'm going to set my face, I'm going to set my mind, and I'm going to pursue this single-mindedly. I am 100% going to devote myself to search for all the understanding and to explore all of wisdom and everything that's being done. So Solomon goes, this is what I set to this. And I went out and I discovered everything that I could. I learned as much as I could. In the next verse, he says, but I soon discovered that God has dealt a tragic existence to the human race. I observed everything going on under the sun, and really it's all meaningless. It's like chasing the wind. He goes, I did it. I went through, and what I realized was that God has given us this tragic existence. That the more and the more and the more we try to gain and get and understand, the more we realize we don't understand. And so you can keep trying to get more and keep trying to get more, and you find yourself in a time loop. Oh yeah, the day keeps going, but you just keep chasing more knowledge and more knowledge and more knowledge. It's like chasing the wind. He then summarizes his observation in the next two statements. What is wrong cannot be made right. What is missing cannot be recovered. Because I got all the knowledge in the world. I had all the wisdom and I did it. And here's my conclusion. No matter how much I learned, the only things that really stand true is that what is wrong cannot be made right and what is missing cannot be recovered. It's the idea of what is not wrong cannot be made right. It's this idea of what is crooked cannot be made straight again. Because as soon as something is crooked and often we try to go and force it to be straight again, well, something else gets crooked. There's always another problem to go after. And we understand this because in our scientific age, right, where we have all of this great data at our backs, and I'm a fan of that, but what happens is we end up trying to use that to fix one problem, and inevitably we create another one. Some of you can remember a day in an age where when we were trying to fight high cholesterol, and you would go to the doctor and they'd run the test and say, hey, you have high cholesterol. We need to do something about that. So from now on, when you cook, I don't want you to cook with butter anymore. I need you to cook with margarine. And so everybody began to cook with margarine. Only to a few years later have the scientific community come out and go, hey, yeah, we were wrong. Margarine is actually worse for your cholesterol than butter was. So everybody go back to cooking with butter. Right? And so we went back to cooking with butter, and now people are like, no. Now you need to cook with olive oil or canola oil or vegetable oil or coconut oil or avocado oil. And now we're like, I don't even know which one is the best one to cook with. And if we stay in the food category, you can remember we've had these debates over the years about eggs, right? Are eggs good for you or are they bad for you? Is it good protein or is it bad protein? It's bad. Okay, no, now it's good. No, it's only the yolks that are good. No, it's the whites that are good. No, now break it up. Eat the shells. Can I eat them raw? I just liked it on Instagram. That's all I know. Right, we're doing this with eggs, and we go. I read a report recently. This one's mind-boggling to me, and I'm a little afraid of it. I read a report recently about sunscreen. Right, and then we all have been taught like lather up with sunscreen, UVA, UVB rays. They're terrible for you. You're gonna get skin cancer. Well, the newest science is coming out says that we so followed that advice that now when we're out in the sun, we're not getting enough of the rays of the sun, even when we are in it, to get the vitamin D that we need. And a deficiency in vitamin D is more unhealthy than the skin cancer you might get. And I'm like, well, what do I do with that information? I don't like a sunburn. Right. Not only that, but the same article said that the sunscreen that we've been using for generations now and in my entire lifetime, it had these chemicals in it, that those chemicals that we, for us, they weren't that bad. But when we got in the water and the salt water rubbed them off, that now it's killing the reef all around the world. So that I wouldn't get a little bit of skin cancer that is most of the time not deathly and curable, we're killing off an entire ecosystem. Now, don't get me wrong here. Put on your sunscreen, okay? Like, don't come in here this summer with a sunburn and be like, I heard your sermon. Like, look at me, I'm doing good, right? Right, and the science is coming out and saying, yeah, the vitamin D pills and drops, they're good, but they actually don't do near as much as we thought they did. Your body does need sun. This is Solomon going, the more information I get, the more I realize that what is wrong cannot be made right. That life is futile because every single time I think I finally understand something, there's something else to be discovered. And then even then, there's things that get lost. And once something is lost, you can't recover it. You don't count it anymore. And this sounds depressing because Solomon is looking around at life and he's saying, listen, we're chasing after it and we're just chasing the wind. I don't know if you've ever been to the beach and sat down on the beach and kind of in a chair or on the beach itself. And when I do that, I inevitably start just sort of digging in the sand a little bit, right? And then there's this moment where I've like dug a little bit deeper and I'm now into my hand and then I'm up to my elbow into the sand. And eventually I'm like having to get out of the chair and keep going. And that mind cross, that thought comes into my mind where I'm like, I'm digging to China. Like, here we go. I'm going to do this because I'm a kid and I never grew up. And so like, I just keep digging and I'm like, this is going to be the deepest hole on this beach that anybody has ever dug. And that's true until I hit the waterline. And then the moment you hit that waterline, you're never going to dig any deeper. You just can't dig any deeper. Oh, the holes will get wider, but it's not going to go any deeper than that. No matter how much you dig, no matter how much you fight, no matter how much more you try to do it, that's as far as you're going to go. Solomon goes, that's what it looks like when you take knowledge and wisdom and you make that your God. Oh, it's gonna take you somewhere and you're gonna have benefits from it and it's gonna be fun, but there is a cap that it can only take you so far. And you're gonna be left going, life is meaningless. Solomon then doubles down on this. He doubles down in the next verse. He says, look, I am wiser than any of the kings who ruled in Jerusalem before me. I have greater wisdom and knowledge than any of them. He goes, I am the king. Remember, I'm the teacher. I have more knowledge, more wisdom than anybody that has ever come behind me. Wisest man ever. Humblest man, not so much. But wisest man ever. So I set out to learn everything. I set out to learn everything from wisdom and madness and folly. He goes, I'm not just going to pursue things that are good for me, that are wise. I'm going to go learn everything that's folly as well. And I learned firsthand that pursuing all of this, it's chasing the wind. And then this next line, you see, the greater my wisdom, the greater my grief. To increase knowledge only increases sorrow. It didn't satisfy. I learned everything I could, and I realized that was chasing the wind. So I set my heart to do it even more so that then I could say that I know more than everyone. And it just made my life more difficult. It didn't give me what I thought it was going to give me. Have you ever had that moment in life where you were chasing after something, or you really wanted something, and you thought, if I can only get this thing or have this deal, and once I have that, then my life will be better. Only to finally receive it and then realize that your life really didn't get any better. Right? Some of you, you're realizing this is true because we're a month out from Christmas, right? Christmas was a month ago. And there was that thing that you really, really wanted for Christmas. And then you got that thing and you thought your life was going to be different. And here we are a month later and you're thinking about that thing right now going, I don't even know where that is anymore. Because we've moved on. That's what Solomon says we do with wisdom as well. And with knowledge, it's not a tangible thing we hold. It's something we seek after and we make it the God in our lives. And then when we do that at the end, we're left with going, I've got more grief than I've ever thought I could have. That next milestone didn't give me what I wanted. And part of the reason that it gives us more grief is because when we get more knowledge, it tends to puff us up. What scripture says, right, is that with more knowledge, you begin to get puffed up. Your head becomes larger. And there was a statue that demonstrated this. I saw it once upon a time somewhere. I spent, again, I researched weird Google things this week. I went on a deep dive trying to find this statue. And it's a statue of a man kind of standing like this, and he's carrying a cart behind him. And he's dragging this cart through the garden where the statue is, and his body is normal sized, but his neck is elongated and it arches backwards to an oversized head that is on the cart. And he's dragging this huge head of his around. Try to Google that. The things you have to Google, man carrying his head on a cart. There's a lot of weird, and I couldn't find it, but I loved this image because I thought, oh, that's what Solomon's telling us. That if I pursue knowledge as my God, it puffs my head up to the point that it now hurts me, where I have to carry it around and I can't help people with it because pride has puffed up. There's probably a great example of this in American history. There's a man by the name of Frank Lloyd Wright. Frank Lloyd Wright he's arguably, but most people agree, the greatest architect that America has ever had. He's the greatest American architect. He's designed thousands of buildings and hundreds of them have been made all around the world. They actually were built and he oversaw some of them. He gave the architectural world some fascinating things. One of the phrases that he coined was this idea of organic architecture. The idea is that if you're going to build a building in nature, you should build it in a way that complements the surrounding areas, not destroys or detracts from it. And it's a beautiful way to think about architecture. And so this is one of the homes and buildings that he designed. But there's another one that he designed that's in Buffalo, New York. He designed it in the early 1900s for Mr. and Mrs. Darwin Martin. And if you look at it there, it's a beautiful home. It's an architectural phenomenon. I mean, the lines are all just so beautiful. And as Frank Lloyd Wright was building this home, we have the correspondence between Darwin and Frank as it was getting built, Darwin being the man whose his family was supposed to come and live into this house. And in the beginning, it's kind of a normal dialogue in these letters that you would expect, but then all of a sudden, things get bitter and sideways, and it doesn't go well. One author I was reading about this, here's what he said about Frank Lloyd Wright in this process. Wright was an egomaniac of gargantuan perspective. He saw his role as the architect and builder, the rights as the ignoramuses who were lucky enough to have the opportunity to live in and pay for a Wright-designed home. You see, Frank Lloyd Wright is the greatest architect that America has ever seen. He has more knowledge and more understanding and more experience with it than anyone, so that he can build this beautiful home. But the Wrights, the Martins, they moved into the home, and they weren't there very long before they moved out again. Because once they got in, they said, yeah, it's beautiful, but it's not functional. And it's not what we wanted. And the architect, in his brilliance and knowledge of the craft, forgot that you don't build a home to look pretty. You build it for people to live in. You see, this is what happens when we begin to gain so much knowledge that we have to drag it around, and we forget about people in the process. And this happens not just in architecture, it happens in business, right? When you set up to create a product or to do something to serve somebody and to make the world a better place, but then you have so much knowledge and information about it that you forget about the people that you set out to serve in the first place. It's what psychologists call the curse of knowledge. The curse of knowledge is this idea that once I have learned something, it's nearly impossible for me to go back and remember what it was like to not know that thing. It's the curse of knowledge. A psychologist in 1990 by the name of Elizabeth did a PhD study on this. And her dissertation was really, really simple. What she did was she took two people and she put them in a room. And one of them was to be the tapper and one of them was to be the listener. And the tapper, she would just give them a list of 120 songs, and they were just supposed to really sit on the table and just tap the song. And they were familiar songs like the Star-Spangled Banner and Happy Birthday and Jingle Bells. And the listener was to just listen to the tapping and then tell the tapper what song they were tapping. They would go through all 120 songs, and at the end of her study, she found that on average, the listeners could identify three of the 120 songs. That's a 2.5% success rate. But the other thing that was they observed during this was that those who were the tappers kept getting frustrated because they're tapping the song, and they're like, "This, it's clearly Happy Birthday. Like, you've literally heard this song at least once a year your entire life." And they would just get so upset because they're just tapping it and it's driving them mad that the person can't get it. But what they didn't realize was the curse of knowledge was happening. They were hearing the song in their head as they were tapping it. For the listener, they just heard random taps. You see, when we pursue knowledge as a God in our life and something that's going to bring us meaning, if I only had more of it, we forget about when the places we were in when we didn't know. And all of a sudden, we're not willing to give grace and care and kindness to people. Because after all, it's very, very clear to me. Why can't you understand this? I would venture to say that every one of us in the room that's ever been in a relationship, and especially if you're married, you'd had those moments where you're like, no, I'm explaining this very clearly right now. And they're like, no, you're not. It's the curse of knowledge. And so this is what Solomon is warning us about. Solomon's going, I have pursued this. I have chased after this. And it wasn't enough. There's another writer in our New Testament, a man named Paul. And Paul, he was an intellectual. He would have been known as a scholar of scholars in his day and age. And he was so brilliant that when he's writing to this letter to the people in Philippi, he's writing the letter of Philippians to them, and he's like making up words in it to explain what God has done in his resurrection. But he's a pastor first, and he cares for them. And there was a letter that he wrote to the region of Ephesus. And here's what Paul had to say in Ephesians chapter 1, starting in verse 16. I pray for you constantly, asking God, the glorious Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, to give you spiritual wisdom and insight so that you might grow in your knowledge of God. Paul goes, listen, I'm praying for you. And I am asking God that you would have spiritual wisdom. I want him to give that to you. I want you to have insight. I want you to grow in knowledge. I want you to have these things. And I want you to understand more of who God is and more of what God has done for you. So I want you to have knowledge. And knowing that he's a scholar of scholars, you'd expect he's like, so I'm going to come and do a seminar. Or I'm going to come and here's this class. Or hey, I've got another book that I've written or another thing. And that's not what he does. the next verse he says, and so I pray. I pray that your hearts will be flooded with light so that you can understand the confident hope he has given to those he called. His holy people who are rich in his glorious inheritance. He's going, so this is what I'm doing. I'm praying for you. I'm praying that you would be flooded with light. Another way to say that is, as I'm praying that you would be enlightened. And not in the same sense that the enlightenment of the 17th and 18th centuries that said, let's throw mystery and faith out the window and just deal with logic and circumstance and scientific method. And if we can come up with a hypothesis and test it over and over and over again, then we know that it's true. That's all fine and we need that. But Paul here is saying, no, there's a different kind of enlightenment that I want you to have, that you would be flooded with light so that you can understand who God is. And so I pray that you understand the incredible greatness of God's power for us who believed in him. This is the same mighty power that has raised Christ from the dead, seated him in the place of honor at God the Father's right hand in the heavenly realms. You see, Paul comes in and he says, chase after knowledge. Go for it. It's good. You can have it. I want you to get it. It just makes a terrible God. It just makes a God that's never going to satisfy. It just makes a God that's going to puff you up and make you good for nothing and miss people in the process. What I want you to do is realize that God is who you should be going after. After all, he's the giver of wisdom. He's the giver of knowledge. He's the giver of life. And please, please, please don't misunderstand me. I am a huge fan of education. I'm a huge fan of gaining wisdom and knowledge as much as we can. In fact, years ago, and I don't know if the stat is true anymore, but it was one that convicted me and stuck in me. Years ago, I read a stat that said, on average around the world, the highest level of education that anybody has is a third grade level of education. After that, it jumps to a sixth grade level, and then it basically just drops off after that. Which is why when I had the opportunity to go and get a master's, I went, okay, this is a gift that has been given to me because of where I was born and the family I was born into, and I need to steward that gift well. It's why currently I'm writing a dissertation and getting a doctorate, because I'm going, I live in a place where I can pursue this and get it, but I can't ever let those degrees become the thing that define me. I have to chase after God first. Wisdom and knowledge and going after it is good, but we need to chase after God as our primary thing. Which is why I think knowing is something, but God is everything. Right? Having knowledge is something, but God, he's absolutely everything. That it's not enough just to know a lot of facts and figures. And I want to know God deeply. For some of us in the room, what that may look like is realizing that you've got questions about our faith. And if you're here and you're going, I'm not so sure about this God thing. I've got too many questions. I haven't bought into that. I want you to know I am so glad that you are here. That you have so many questions, and this is a safe place to come and to ask those questions. But at some point, you have to be willing to take the step of faith and say, even without all of my questions being answered, God, I'm going to trust you. Because knowledge is something, but it's not everything. And we can understand that because a lot of us in the room are married. Right? And there was this moment where I stood at the altar with my wife and we said, I do to one another. But we were young and we had no idea who I was, much less who she was in that moment. Right? And we had no idea about marriage. We just said, you know what? We're going to commit to do this together. We've still got a ton of questions. I still have a ton of questions. But then I had even more. And I'm like, God, I'm asking you. I'm going to just trust that this is what I'm going to step into. Or if you're a parent in the room, you know that you're not ready to be a parent when you become a parent. Right? You're at the hospital and there's this moment where the nurse comes in and says, hey, I need you to load the baby into the car seat and show me that you know how to safely put the baby in the car seat. And you're like, okay, good. This is my first kid. Could you show me how to do that? And the nurse goes, no, I need to know that you know how to do it. And she leaves the room and you're like, car seat, baby, YouTube. And so you go and you look it up on YouTube, right? And you research, like, how do you put a baby in a car seat? And so you watch it and you get the kid all strapped in and you're like, hey, nurse, right? And you're like, you hope that's right. And she comes and she says, okay, good, you're discharged. And then you're carrying the baby out and all of a sudden you go, hold on, that was the test? Like, that was it. I YouTubed that thing. Like, I don't know what I'm doing. There's not enough YouTube videos out there to help me be a good parent. I have a ton of questions about this. But you go and you do it anyway. I believe that for some in the room, God is saying, listen, you're never going to have all your questions answered. Because that's not where the meaning of life is found. It's not in knowing something, it's in knowing someone. And so come and take the step of faith and trust me, and let's continue on this journey that is life. For others of us, though, I think there's maybe some in the room where you've been following God for a long time. You've been chasing after him, and maybe you've fallen into the trap of hitting Bible study after Bible study. And if any church in the area is open and willing and has their doors, you're there because you want to consume more and learn more. And then you're always trying to get information. And you come on a Sunday morning and you sit there and you wait for that pithy nugget of wisdom that's going to be something that you didn't know about the scriptures before. And now you leave satisfied because you learned something new. But in the process, you missed God in the midst of it. Because you just gained more knowledge and you missed the God of that knowledge. See, I'm thoroughly convinced that a lot of us that have been walking with Jesus for a long time are already educated beyond the level of our obedience. And so I go, God, like I want to learn more about you. You are an infinite God and there is always more to learn, but let me continue to put it into action as well. Otherwise, I'm just puffing myself up with things about you rather than being filled with the spirit that is in me that has the same power of the resurrection of Jesus is in me. I want to get some more of that. I want to understand the spirit more that is in me and how he wants to work through me. See, we have to be willing to come and say, God, you are everything for me. I can't just gain in knowledge. I can't just grow in who you are. God, no, I want to know all of who you are. One pastor I heard, he put it this way, and I just think this is absolutely brilliant. He said, it's as if you were to go to your teenage daughter and say, hey, sweetheart, I want you to clean your room. Could you go upstairs and clean your room? She's like, yeah, Dad, no problem. She goes upstairs, you hear her in her room for a minute, and you kind of forget about it. And then you look up about 30 minutes later and you're like, oh, I'm gonna go check on her. So you go and you kind of knock on the door and she answers and you look in your room and you're like, you've been up here 30 minutes, your room's not clean. And she's like, oh yeah, yeah, Dad, I know, but I came up here to clean my room. He's like, did you really hear me? Like, did you hear me say, clean your room? She's like, yeah, Dad, I heard you. I heard you say, clean your room. And so I came in here and I walked into my room and I saw it and I went, clean your room. What does that mean? I mean, what is really going on with that? What is clean? Who defines that? And your, it's this possessive word. Like, whose room is this? Do we own anything really? And Dad, I pondered on it so much that I realized I couldn't do it on my own. And so I got on FaceTime or Snapchat and then I got my friends together and we began to look together and to study what does it mean to clean your room. God, Dad, one of my friends, they had this book where we could go and look up the etymology of the word and dig into the original meaning. Dad, did you know in Latin that this is what it means to clean your room? So, Dad, I know more right now about what it means to clean my room than I ever have. Clean your room. We get it. That when we pursue more information about God but don't follow through in the obedience of God, we've missed the point. This is what Solomon is warning us about. Solomon said, I chased after it. I went after it. And I said, this is going to satisfy. And it didn't. Which I think leaves one question for us this morning. The question I want to ask is, how is God asking you to trust his wisdom? In your life, in the things that maybe don't make sense right now. The future that you're not so sure of, the places where logic defies, the relationships that you're in, the business decisions that you have to make, the things that are going on right now, what is it that God is saying, trust me? Trust me. It's not always going to make sense. It's not always the most logical. It isn't the thing that adds up the most. I'm asking you to trust me with it and then be obedient in it. And to just one day at a time, one step at a time, say, God, I want more of who you are. And so help me to grow in trusting you more than I do my own intellect.